The Tom Woods Show, episode 1372.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, creating an online course can be an excellent way of establishing yourself as an authority. It's also a great first product. And if you know what you're doing, it can generate you some real smackers. But how do you do it? Well, I have a teensy-weensy bit of experience with online courses, and I've put together some material that takes you through step-by-step exactly what to do and then how to market that course so people find out about it and buy it. Get these free resources at tomwoods.com/makecourses. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Michael Malice is back on the show. We're going to wrestle with these terms left and right. I've had a lot of requests for an episode on this. What do the terms mean, particularly in this day and age? And is it true that they hinder rather than help in terms of analysis? Are they useful or not? And if they are useful, what do they mean, particularly today? As you know, Michael is a celebrity ghostwriter and a very successful one. He's also an author in his own right. We've talked to him about his book, Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. And you can find him on Compound Media, where he hosts Nightshade, and on his signature program, You're Welcome, on the Gas Digital Network. I'll link to both of those at tomwoods.com/1372. His website, michaelmalice.com. Michael f***ing Malice, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. I've had a lot of requests for a show like this, and I did one like this, but it was like episode 14. So only the crazy people. And I mean that, and I say that in a tender, with a tender tone, who have listened to all the episodes would even remember that.
Not off the air, you don't.
what's said off the air stays off the air. I want to ask you, I have a conversation with you about the terms and categories left and right, because of course they have multiple meanings, but I do believe they have a meaning. And sometimes libertarians get a little carried away saying either that they don't exist or they're phony or they're kind of made up to pit us against each other when they really shouldn't, or things of that sort, or that they don't apply to libertarians.
Right.
Or that libertarians are just plumb line libertarians are neither left nor right.
Right.
And maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but I think it's more asserted than proved most of the time. And so I thought it would be useful to do that. So today, for instance, now I can understand, let me just set this up a little bit. Back in the Ron Paul days, I understand why some people felt like the left-right divide is not that helpful, because sometimes by left-right divide, people meant Democrats versus Republicans. And there, well, you know, the U.S. government with its two major parties, they tend to close ranks when there are dissenters. And the idea that these two, the Democrats and the Republicans, are where the real fight is to be found, well, it's more plausible today than it was 10 years ago, but we just weren't buying it. We were thinking we have more in common on some things with Ralph Nader than we do with Mitt Romney. In fact, maybe on almost everything. I don't even know. But the point is, people thought there's something screwy about this. But I think that was just because the terms were not being correctly applied. I think there is something to it. There's no way you're going to tell me that there isn't a left in America. Then we'll just use another word if it makes people feel better. But there certainly is. But yet within that term, within the left, there are divisions and stuff. What would you say if you had to just kind of sum up for a complete newbie to politics? If you had to explain, what is the fundamentals of what it means to be on the left and on the right? What would it boil down to, in your opinion?
Well, there's a few. I'm going to get to that in a second, but let's get a little bit more fundamental, because you touched on some things that I think are certainly important. There are people who have this, and this is not just exclusive to libertarians, although I think libertarians do tend to be often far more literal-minded than people from other political persuasions. And when you're dealing with literal-minded people, it's very hard to discuss semantics because their minds simply don't work in those terms. And they also get very angry and very frustrated. And there's also a big problem where people have this idea that I'm X, the bad people are Y, and therefore they're going to draw this nice little line, and all the bad qualities are going to be ascribed to Y, and all the good qualities are going to be ascribed to X. And the classic example of this with right and left is that left means government, right means freedom. So Hitler and Stalin are the same, and anarchism is right wing. Well, when I ask them, well, do you think that there's no difference between right wing anarchists like Rothbard and left wing anarchists like, you know, like Emma Goldman or Kropotkin or something like that? I don't even know if Kropotkin's an anarchist or Proudhon or one of them. They'll say, yeah, they're the same thing. It's just like, okay, I mean, that is false. Certainly, if you and I sat down with, you know, Emma Goldman, we would have our disagreements, although our analysis on certain things would certainly be very, very close, and we'd be able to have a conversation. But, you know, this just stems from taxonomy. On the one hand, you can say, you know, bats and sparrows are the same because they fly. Or you could say ostriches and penguins are the same because they're birds that don't fly. But then you could say ostriches and lions are the same because they're predators. So there's different ways to, you know, slice the apple. One thing that you can't say is, well, we're neither right nor left. That's not how an axis works. You have nowhere else to go. You have to be somewhere on this axis. And the problem also is sometimes libertarianism have what are traditionally left-wing elements and traditionally right-wing elements. So it's kind of a hodgepodge. But just because those elements are there does not mean this person defies categorization. That is a linguistic impossibility in my view. So there's certain things. And when people use these terms, they often use them instinctually. They don't really have coherent definitions. And that's why the conversations get messy. Well, most people don't use most words, you know, with coherent definitions. They just use them very loosely, especially as words are thrown out into the vernacular. So the first distinction I would define right versus left would be egalitarianism versus hierarchy. Do you aspire to equality, or any reference to equality is leftism? And now a lot of people get triggered by this because they don't like leftism. They like equality. Therefore, they don't like this definition. Well, too bad. Right wingism historically means hierarchy and an understanding, appreciation, or even admiration of hierarchy. So that would be one very clear and easy distinction that is used. And I think that's used very commonly, although maybe not consciously.
First of all, okay, we definitely want to talk about that. I'm glad you mentioned the idea of the spectrum running from authoritarianism on the left and to freedom on the right, because I get this so often on social media from people who are, you know, kind of sympathetic to my point of view. And they just think, well, what's the point of talking about it? It's really easy. You know, if you believe in freedom, then you're farther on the right side of the spectrum. And if you believe in authoritarianism, you're on the left. But first of all, number one, that kind of big philosophical question is not the only thing that left and right are interested in, first of all. But secondly, that's not even really true, because there are plenty of people who clearly are on the right. There's no other way to describe them, who do think that the state would be appalled at the idea of anarchism, who think that the state—
Or even minarchism.
I beg your pardon?
Or even minarchism.
Or even minarchism. They believe that— they believe in the way George Will has a book called Statecraft as Soulcraft. They believe that because man is fallen, the state needs to create the atmosphere in which he is most likely to be able to live a virtuous life. And if that means the state needs to intervene in family life, in censorship and whatever, then they'll do it. And that's clearly right wing. And that involves a considerable state. So that is wrong to think of it that way. Do not, as of this episode, stop thinking of it that way. Now, your point about equality and hierarchy is very important. Back in the, and just in case everybody doesn't get this already, Michael and I talk a lot, and we're friends. And so when we are on each other's shows, it's a conversation more than a, you know, like a stilted interview. So I do want to have this in that kind of format. We think about equality back in the 19, it was either 70s or 80s, in Modern Age, which was the publication that has been, I guess, at least since the 50s, Russell Kirk founded, conservative publication put out by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, scholarly journal. Harry Jaffa, who was a Straussian, had a debate with M.E. Bradford, who was the guy who was put up to be by Reagan the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and then the neocons smeared him, so he had to withdraw his name. And then we got Bill Bennett. Thank heavens, we got Bill Bennett. Anyway, Bradford and Jaffa had a famous debate on whether equality with a capital E was a conservative principle. And Jaffa said, absolutely it is. And Bradford said, no, it's not. And he had all his reasons, and his main reason was because it is an engine of permanent revolution. which is the opposite of what a conservative believes. But let me ask you, though, about the hierarchy end of that question, because I guess it sort of depends on the kind of hierarchy you have in mind. I mean, if you go back way, way back in history, then the right wing would have been the people who favored the hereditary aristocracy and or the traditional privileges of the monarchy and so on.
Right.
Whereas Thomas Jefferson, who I know is not your favorite historical figure, he clearly did believe in a natural elite. But his idea of the natural elite was one that was voluntarily recognized by people, not one that had hereditary privileges. And in this day and age, nobody basically favors hereditary privileges for an elite. So even people who believe in hierarchy, nevertheless, are kind of, you know, they don't believe in a enforced inequality. So that is kind of an evolution of the right wing, is it not?
I mean, Jefferson was hardly a full-blown leftist. But in the context of that spectrum of the founding fathers, him and his group would be the left-hand group. He was the one who spoke about all men are created equal and things like this. So equality was his kind of watchword. You don't really see Hamilton, who would be the aristocratic impulse, speaking in terms of those concepts. And Jefferson's idea of hierarchy, again, he's relatively left. These terms also have relative and are contextual. His idea of hierarchy wasn't this stratified, you know, levels like a Hamilton would have. It would really be the dirt farmers, who he said are the, you know, basically are children of God. And then you have the, you know, the landed gentry and slaves, but we didn't really talk about them in his conception. So it's basically like two tiers. And even then he wasn't particularly comfortable with the idea that some men are better than others. Like, here's another example. John Locke, who obviously, for everyone listening, was the, I would say, most influential political philosopher of the revolutionary era, he said in one of his treatises that people are basically the same and that the differences don't really matter. So you have to get to contemporary times or maybe Marxism to have this real full-blown leftism with the idea that human beings are inherently interchangeable and equal in that sense. And you see that nowadays. There's these attempts to make us all interchangeable and kind of, you know, force the meat through the grinder and the cookie cutters. But yeah, it's just you made a reference, which I think is important. The concept of left and right historically comes from the French legislature, where the aristocrats sat on the right, you know, the conservative, you know, aristocrats, and then the radicals and the, you know, men of the people sat on the left. So that is one of the bases of right and left historically. But other points are, there's another way to view right versus left, which is, and I'll point something else out regarding conservatism. Richard Ely, why don't you tell these people who Richard Ely is, one of the most evil men who ever lived in America?
Well, my recollection is he was the head of the American Economic Association.
Co-founder, yeah.
Okay. And as somebody who lived around the, you know, early 20th century and at the turn of the century, I would think of him as being one of the architects of the modern American progressive mind, that we're going to have an elite group of experts who, armed with these sheaths of statistics, are going to administer things for the dummies. I mean, they don't quite put it that way, but
that's
the way they think.
Oh, yeah. I read one of his books. He was one of the founders of the social gospel, the idea that instead of individual salvation, you have to have a nation that is saved in the Christian sense. And he explicitly says, don't tell the masses their lives are going to be better or that they have opportunity. They don't. Make their lives better for them and basically have them put some nice trimmings in their squalor. And the last chapter of his autobiography, and he was Woodrow Wilson's mentor. Woodrow Wilson is the archetypical progressive, even more than Teddy Roosevelt or FDR. The last chapter of Richard Ely's book, his autobiography, which I just recently got a signed copy of, My Belief in the Equality of Opportunity. This was a progressive left-wing concept. And you know my quote, Tom, I say this on Twitter every 5 seconds, that conservatism is progressivism driving the speed limit. All these ideas that conservatives fight for have their roots in progressive dogma, and they often don't even realize it. And let me say one more. Can I give you another example?
Yeah, go ahead.
Another example of right versus left is an emotional one. Do you sympathize with the weak, or do you empathize with the strong? So when people talk about law and order being right wing and bleeding hearts being left wing, this is a categorization that they're using. Do you want to be, you know, the strong man? You know, strong man historically, political strong men are regarded as, you know, right wing. Whereas, you know, Mother Teresa and people like that are regarded as left wing. So these terms also apply in non-political context, but in social context.
I can see that. But with that kind of approach, does that then place Ayn Rand on the right just clearly?
Oh, yes, of course.
All right. I mean, so
is that in dispute?
No, no, no. I just want to make sure that everybody gets that there are, you know, that these terms do in fact mean something. But in terms of hierarchy, though, how does that manifest itself today? I mean, almost nobody expressly gives voice to the idea of hierarchy in a favorable way these days. So how does it manifest itself?
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think when people talk about how, you know, we need the people who graduated college to have opportunities to express their talents, and when they say, you know, defend the CIA and law and the government, that in a sense is hierarchy worship. That's a kind of a right-wing concept. I don't know that they would use the term hierarchy because it's kind of a fancy word. And the Republicans certainly are scared to be – they've been so browbeaten for, you know, decades of progressive education, progressive cultural domination that they're not going to speak of, you know, whatever. But, you know, the example I used when I was on Rogan, and this is my litmus test and it works every single time. If you ask – this is how you could tell if someone's right wing or not. You ask them a simple question. Are some people better than others? And if you're on the right, you're going to say yes. And if you're on the left, you're going to deliver a speech. Those are the only two results for this question, because the left will have that cognitive dissonance where on the one hand, that's against their core beliefs. On the other hand, they realize the absurdity of saying no. So they'll just start spurting out.
But I've had people respond to your question by asking, what do you mean by better?
Right. You say answer however way you want, and they'll either say yes or they'll start freaking out. Do not explain.
Let me throw in an idea or two of my own about left and right. So first of all, the very idea of we're going to launch a national program to accomplish A or B, or we're going to take all these people with PhDs in political science and we're going to put them in charge of such and such, that's the left-wing mindset. The conservative or right-wing, let's not even use conservative. On the right, the idea is more – the prosaic pursuit of bourgeois life is perfectly satisfactory to these people.
Right.
That is to say, they don't need to crusade against the latest outrage. They don't need to reprogram the way people think. They don't need to change ancient traditions. If these things are going to change, they'll change gradually and organically, not through some state-imposed scheme. And those two sorts of things, it's very hard for them to coexist peacefully.
Yeah.
So we've got that. Now,
I don't know that, but Tom, I think just because things have historically appeared in the left half of the spectrum and the right half of the spectrum, I don't know that they're inherently left or right wing in terms of classification, because there's certainly many right wingers. I mean, Rand, the entire point of Atlas Shrugged is we should have these experts running everything. Now, they're not running everything through force, but she explicitly said that men of the mind should be listened to. So this kind of how to define culture in terms of, you know, where the what do we do with the experts and whatever. I don't know that that ports necessarily to left or right wing any more than, let's suppose, vegetarianism is inherently left wing or right wing. There's lots of reasons for it. I think it would depend on your reasoning for why you're going to be for left or right wing. But I agree with you completely. In America, this idea of the experts, the technocrats, are going to run everything, that very much came out of the progressive movement.
Now, I'm looking right now at the so-called 10 conservative principles.
Oh, God.
That come I know, heaven help us. But they come out of Russell Kirk.
Ugh.
And I'm just going to read, I know, but I'm going to read them, and I think it might be helpful as an exercise to evaluate them.
But, and before you read them,
yeah.
I'm sure I would point out, I've seen these before, a lot of these are worded in such weaselly ways that they could be interpreted to mean anything.
That is indeed the problem. And that's why I keep saying that conservatism is like nailing jelly to a wall. I don't know what, and that's why people are constantly arguing who's a real conservative. Now, it's true, you know, I know you don't identify necessarily yourself as a libertarian, but you know that in the libertarian world, there are people who argue that this one's a better libertarian than that one.
Sure.
But at least there's some kind of standard we
can measure
it by. Whereas this, I don't know what. So he begins with, first, the conservative believes that there exists an enduring moral order.
How is that inherent to – I mean, you're telling me that the evangelical left in this country
does not –
they're not moralists?
Yeah, they are as moralist as you could be. The whole point is that you are a reprobate.
Right.
And you need to be morally uplifted. So, all right. Now, I mean, on the other hand, maybe the weasel word here is enduring, because he could say their moral order changes every 3 years as they discover new victims to rescue. But it's the same general principle.
Yeah.
All right. Second, the conservative adheres to custom, convention, and continuity. All right. Well, then this is part of the problem that Rothbard saw with conservatism, which was once leftism becomes the custom.
Right.
Then what does the conservative do?
We know
what he does. He sits there and does nothing.
I had Lauren Southern on my show, the activist, right-wing activist. And she, you know, we were talking about immigration. And I said, are you honestly going to tell me that progressivism isn't like American as apple pie, which apparently isn't that American, that Woodrow Wilson isn't as white as it gets? I mean, it baffles the mind to think that progressivism is some kind of alien ideology when it's very much a product of this country and its history, especially at this point. It's what he was president 100 years ago.
Well, then we've got conservatives believe in what may be called the principle of prescription. All right. Well, we could talk about that, but I think that would be boring. So then conservatives are guided by their principle of prudence. Now, see, that's just not helpful.
But that's, I mean, not most people, that's not really a principle. That's just an approach.
Right. Right. Because prudence applies in all – and plus, really anybody could say that – almost anybody claims to be – well, I guess an outright revolutionary would not say –
Sure, but
here's but on the other hand, they would say, but look, it is the prudent thing. The prudent thing is like basically doing the right thing at the right time. And maybe overthrowing the bourgeoisie is the right thing.
Well, no, Tom, I'll give you even a better example. It's prudent to have socialized healthcare because all these other countries spend less on healthcare than we do, right? That's an argument they use all the time with a straight face. Here's another thing, just as a sidebar, you know, these minarchists who say, I want the smallest government that's necessary to be effective. Would Hillary Clinton disagree with that? No. The left would say this with a straight face. I also want the smallest government necessary. We're just haggling over that, what that is. The principle is right. Identical.
And of course, this is we hear so-called conservatives talking about, like I guess Rick Santorum the other day was saying, it's time to have paid family leave. Of course it is.
Well, it's
why wouldn't it?
Then the argument is, well, he's not a real conservative. Okay. So a real conservative is a conservative you like? Okay. That's not how it works.
Yeah, exactly. Because he'll say, no. I mean, the family is the bedrock of society. And having a mother home with her children. I mean, I already know the speech. I already know it. I don't even need to think about it. Then he says, conservatives pay attention to the principle of variety. It's a very weaselly, again, another
wait,
weaselly
you're telling
one.
Me the left? I mean, I know the argument is that these people all look like freaks and they all end up looking the same. I'm sorry. The left are the people who live in the cities, who love, you know, foreign food and foreign films and all this weird stuff. So at the very least, it's a wash.
It's a wash because they believe in some forms of variety, but then they do, when it comes to ideology, they do demand uniformity.
But culturally, and they are far stronger in terms of wanting variety. Which is not necessarily always a good thing. You know, this isn't a celebration of the left. I'm saying if you're going to put culturally who has more variety, the conservatives or the liberals, this is not going to be an argument that Russell Kirk is going to win. The man who refused to get a car because he thought it would take people away from where they were born.
Right, right. Or he never learned how to drive. He would let other people drive him around, but he never learned. Sounds like a certain Russian immigrant I know.
Yeah,
anyway, number
six.
Anyway, number six, I remember my favorite time of driving you was when you got in late to the airport. We had to get you to the Mises Institute, and I broke every law there was to zoom you back to Auburn.
But that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's good. All right. This one I actually will give him. He says conservatives are chastened by their principle of imperfectibility. And of course, here he just means the idea that you could create a new Soviet man or that eventually through evolution, education will make man perfect or abolishing alcohol will make man, all these sorts of things a Russell Kirk guy would correctly roll his eyes at.
I'm going to disagree a little bit because, again, this could be interpreted several ways. I'm going to paraphrase Margaret Thatcher. Being humble is like being a lady. If you have to tell people you are, you aren't. So the idea that Russell Kirk and the National Review crowd are chastened by their imperfectibility, are they really speaking, you know, softly? Are they being like, oh, maybe I could be wrong? Or are they absolutely smug, as even more smug than the, you know, a sensible left?
Okay.
So there's two ways to read it, on a personal level. And then there's also the good sense, which is the idea that people are always going to be flawed, which also I don't necessarily – is a right-wing idea. I don't necessarily agree with it, because if something's inherently flawed, then the term flawed doesn't really apply.
I wonder about that, though. That I'd have to chew on a bit, because I could imagine – yeah, I don't know. That's interesting.
If something's
interesting.
A part of your nature, it's not a mistake. It's just your nature. A mistake is a deviation from your nature.
I think that's the way Rand would put it.
Correct. That, I am quoted. This is very much Rand's idea.
The idea would be, we're just not good enough for socialism.
Right.
Is what sometimes comes out of the right wing. If we could be better, then we could have socialism. And I hate that line of argument.
Oh, it drove her crazy. It drove her crazy.
Then we get this. Conservatives are persuaded that freedom and property are closely linked. But libertarians can go farther than that.
But you're telling me liberals aren't?
Well, they would say that
– they would agree with that sentence as written. They would apply it. They would agree with it.
As written – with modifications. Of course, everybody knows we have to put restrictions on it. We have to do this and that.
Right, but we still have to have a property-based society. I'm not a communist. They would say it, and they'd be correct in saying it.
Yeah, because I would say most of them don't want somebody – you know. If somebody comes to rob their house, they're going to call the police.
But and in all seriousness, they don't want full-blown communism where the government owns everything. They don't.
Yeah, they don't. That's true. That's true. But there are some who do, and he would say that a conservative disagrees with that.
Sure.
But your point would be it's not only – you're not excluding enough people.
That doesn't make it an inherently conservative value.
Well, then he says – and this one – I mean, this does kind of speak to some stuff that I've – written. Conservatives uphold voluntary community quite as they oppose involuntary collectivism.
Okay.
So that's fair enough. And particularly if you want to go start your little socialist community, as some people did in the 19th century, go ahead, knock yourselves out.
Yeah.
But to tell people in, I don't know if it was somewhere around a dozen time zones, that you are now Soviets, which is an identity that did not exist 10 minutes ago. But that is the identity you have now. And we're all going to act as if that's all you have. We object to that. But again, remember the social democrats in America, like Arthur Schlesinger, wanted to fight the Cold War as much as anyone. So again, it's not enough to – I think these are not enough. So then he says, the conservative perceives the need for prudent restraints upon power and upon human passions.
Who doesn't?
Again,
the left
who
does
doesn't?
Too.
Yeah.
The whole point of civil rights legislation is that.
Well, then we get the thinking conservative understands that permanence and change must be recognized and reconciled in a vigorous society. Again, this is not helpful because most people I know on the left, they don't genuinely want to overturn everything. They don't want to turn Broadway into a strip mall, for example. I mean, there are things that they don't want to abolish Shakespeare in the Park. The question is how much permanence and how much change. So this particular principle is not a guide.
Obama quoted this principle himself. He said, look, if we were starting from scratch, I would want single payer, but we have a system now, so we have to work with what we have and try to get there. That's exactly the Russell Kirk principle that he's quoting right here.
So I think this is why – this is part of the reason that conservatism just hasn't really – gone anywhere in terms of successes. If you have a book of conservative successes, it's pretty darn small.
Correct.
I don't understand. I don't see what's so attractive. And then in the political version, the slogans for it are not particularly attractive. And so all they can come up with is the left is much worse. And the left is very bad on a lot of things, but I still maintain you can't beat something with nothing. What is it that you want? You don't want this program and you don't want that program. What do you want?
And hold on.
And it's so hard to get an answer.
Saying someone else is worse is not a principle. A principle exists independently of other people or other actors. So many of these principles are comparative to the left in the sense of they're bad, we're not as bad, but they're not really coherent in and of themselves. For example, politically, historically, the principle is we should have a balanced budget. Okay, does that mean you raise tax? According to that, if that is your principle, right? If that is your principle, then raising taxes and thereby revenue and cutting spending would both be principally identical. So you could have 70% taxes and, you know, $7 trillion budget, or 10% taxes and $10 trillion budget. They'd be the same. That's not a guide to action in terms of what you're going to do. It's just for equality in an economic sense.
If I were to try to define it, and I've done a lot of talking about this, it's easier for me to define what the left is all about than it is for me to define what the right is all about.
Because they have principles.
Yeah, they do. Whereas with the right, there's this sense, partly it's that the right, if they really are authentically right-wing, there's a part of them that really does not want to be political, does not want to have to formulate a program. Because formulating a program is kind of the opposite of what the right is all about. The right is supposed to be about maintaining what they believe to be the basic building blocks of civilization that you just don't mess with, and that you proceed with caution when you want to implement change. And there are certain ways society works that can't be messed with without major problems. And one of those is the economy, but not the only one. You can't have state ownership of the means of production and expect that to work. There are certain private property is one of many aspects of society that is essential to its proper functioning. And there ought to be some deference given to traditional practice. Doesn't mean that tradition is always right. There can be horrible traditions, but that before you go knocking something down, you need to give it serious thought about what function it performs.
Or that's, you know, Chesterton's fence is the best example of this. Before you knock down a fence, make sure you know why it was put up.
Right.
It's an asymmetry. It's easier to destroy something than to build something. Therefore, the cost might be pretty high to tear it down, as opposed to the cost being, or even a benefit being there if you leave it.
Whereas, the thing is that when we just boil it down to, well, we believe in liberty and they don't, well, to some degree, depending on how you define liberty, there is something to that. Like libertarians believe in it and these people don't. But the thing is, the way the left would look at it, they would say, because for instance, I do believe that a good portion of the history of libertarianism is actually a case of the left develop. I mean, I think the libertarianism more or less begins as a left-wing-ish movement, because what else could it be in the context of that time? But what happened was, this is what I think happened. You know, obviously, that the term classical liberal refers to something very different from modern day American liberalism.
Sure.
Well, how did that come about? Well, what seems to me what happened is they wanted to get rid of restrictions, you know, they wanted to get rid of state restrictions, tariffs, restrictions on commerce, all kinds of restrictions of this kind. And they thought that this would have a good effect on all of society, which indeed it did. But I think some of them thought it would have a more equalizing effect than it actually did. So when that turned out, when removing state restrictions turned out to have disappointing results from their point of view, they thought, all right, well, now we need to go to the next level, which is now we need to get the state involved to continue the equalization process. And I think it developed from that kind of liberalism to modern liberalism, just saying that, well, you guys are just unreasonable. Look, we tried that and it had some good effects. But now we're just going to, you know, the state was used to hurt the average man in the past. Now we're going to use it supposedly to help him. And so what they're thinking is the individual will be helped and will have more liberty because we will use the state to give him more opportunities, more wealth, and thereby more flexibility to live his life the way he wants to. And isn't that more freedom?
Yeah.
That's the way they think of it.
It's the sarcastic, oh, you mean I have the freedom to starve?
Exactly.
So that's what they're fighting. There's two other ways to look at left versus right. One of which is, and this sounds like a criticism and it's not, the right is for the inclusionism versus exclusionism. Should everything be made as accessible to everyone as much as possible? That's a left-wing idea. Or are there some things just for me? And that's not, it's not really something that we should be fighting for. That is very much a very left versus right divide. And that ties into another way to look at left and right, which is a veneration of the outsider or us versus them. That's a left versus right wing idea. Now, again, when people hear that, they have these quick reactions of like, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes veneration of the outsider is good. You want to let people into your society because they're going to add value. sometimes it's really bad. The Trojan horse being a great example, or things like of that nature. So these divides are not, you know, one side is inherently good, one side is inherently bad. There are situations where one principle would apply and one wouldn't. And another way to look at left versus right is, are you someone who is attracted to the new and something that you haven't seen before? Or, you know, this conservative, like, I like what I have and that's fine. That second group, although I don't belong to it, you need those very, very, very much to have continuity in a society. If you had every 20 years of revolution and things getting overthrown, that is not a country you want to live in.
Agreed. Agreed. So, all right. So now, so here's why I think it's possible to look at libertarianism today. And in a way, I could see both sides being right in trying to classify it. Like, for instance, you could be extremely traditional and say, look, I don't like any aspect of the modern world. I don't like being told what I'm supposed to believe about families or gender or any of this stuff. And I just want to secede from it. I want to be left alone. I don't want any of these impositions placed on me. I don't want to be forced to say I believe something I don't believe. I don't want my kids educated that way. I just want to be left alone to conduct my life as I want. That person can be a perfectly good libertarian in good standing. There are libertarians who will hate that person, but that's their private petty hatreds. That has nothing to do with the ideology. On the other hand, there are libertarians who say, I want to be free from the state so that I can live unusual lifestyles. And
sure.
Okay, but that, given that politics is not all of life and therefore does not sum up entirely what it means to be left or right, those people who believe that it's their duty to knock down traditional institutions and ways of thought, those people belong on the left. What binds them together is that if they are people of goodwill, they can say, look, I don't really like the way you plan to live your life and you don't like the way I plan to live mine, but this is a big world and there's plenty of room for both of us as long as we just agree to leave each other alone, you know, and have that much goodwill toward each other. And yet even the libertarian movement can't seem to show that kind of goodwill toward each other half the time.
Yeah, and I also want to point out one thing. You know, my question about left versus right, there was someone on my Facebook, I forget who it was, and he went on for half an hour, like literally half an hour of walls of text in reaction to my simple yes or no question. And he said, I assure you that if you met me, you would consider me right wing. And I just said, the data says otherwise. So I think in a sense, this is like the trans issue where people are like, where they don't like, they're like, well, I'm right wing. This classification would put me on the left wing. Therefore, the classification's wrong. It's like, no, no, no. You just have this idea of yourself that doesn't port to how this classification makes you feel, and this is causing you some kind of psychological distress. That doesn't necessarily mean the classification's wrong. It could be that your self-image is wrong and that in certain contexts you would be regarded as left-wing, and that's okay. It's not, neither of these terms are loaded in terms of moral or in terms of a quality of a person at all. They are classification terms.
Let me ask you this. First of all, when you hear the terms right wing and conservative, I can distinguish between those mainly because when I hear conservative, I just think of the official conservative movement in the U.S. with its think tanks and its media personalities.
Right.
Is that how you distinguish between these terms? And is there one of those terms that you're more drawn to than the other to describe yourself?
I don't describe myself in either of these terms because I think people use them in such incoherent ways that when you start ascribing it, it's very – because politics is made binary in our country, right? All someone needs to hear is, oh, he's right wing or, oh, she's left wing, and they don't need to listen anymore. So there's no benefit in my view unless you're trying to build an audience within one of these two tribes to use one of these two terms. And it's very clear to me and I think to you in certain one of these classifications, I'm right wing. In certain ones, like being a New Yorker, I would be culturally very, very left-wing. And I have no problem, and nor do I care, nor do you care, in which in some context he's on the right, some context he's on the left. That's fine. I'm someone and you're someone who's interested in taking ideas and people as they come and not putting them necessarily in a box as a mechanism of knowing whether to give them either another second of my time.
Right. Right, right. I just like interesting people.
Yeah.
And I find somebody like Kirkpatrick Sale, who was part of the New Left, to be infinitely more interesting than any neocon I might encounter at some conservative conference. It would just be mind-numbing because Sale would be more interesting, more original, more well-read. It would just be embarrassing even to compare them. Let me ask you about something I said.
Let me say one more thing. Just build up. Yeah. I'm sorry. This is, I think, an Achilles heel of the right, which is because of the right wing psychological. You know, and I think a lot of times many aspects of politics are based on psychology. Jonathan Haidt talks about this a lot. I think the culturally conservative psychological aversion to what is new. It's, you know what I mean? And like, I haven't seen this before. It's weird. I don't like it. This gives the left the biggest possible cultural advantage because by them embracing all the new, embracing the freaks, but also embracing the geniuses, right? If you are in the middle, a genius and a lunatic are equidistant from you and you can't tell the difference between them because they're both something you've never seen in several standard deviations from that which you know. The left gets the front row seats and they get to be the ones who welcome all the innovators. And that is a huge competitive advantage that the right hasn't even articulated, let alone grappled with.
All right, as we wrap up, let me ask you something about something I said in a recent episode. It was just something that came out. I was thinking about when you drive around, you see occasional car with a bumper sticker. Once in a while, you see a car with two bumper stickers. But once in a great while, you see a car covered in bumper stickers.
Yeah.
And 99 times out of 100, that's a car full of left-wing bumper stickers, almost always.
Well, it depends where you are. If you're in the Midwest, you know, certain places in the Midwest, it's going to be right-wing, but yeah.
Okay, that could be. I put in my time in the Midwest for a while, and I don't remember seeing that many you saw a lot of cars that had right-wing messages on them.
But no, Topeka is going to try to position itself as left-wing against the rest of Kansas, right? So it's going to be a relative—
That's true. Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, it was the capital city and all that. But I think in general, I think it's fair to generalize that most of the time when I see, let's say, a backpack that's covered with pins or a car that's covered with bumper stickers— they seem to have a left-wing message, and I was arguing that's not a coincidence.
Of course not a coincidence.
So why do you think it's not a coincidence?
Because
how does that sum up – like, how does that reflect the left-wing way of thinking?
I don't know if it reflects left-wing cultural dominance. You walk around somewhere with a MAGA hat and you walk around somewhere with a pussy hat. What are going to be the reactions to you? The first one is – the second one's not really – the MAGA hat, you're not going to have much benefit, but you might actually be physically assaulted. And the pussy hat, people are going to roll their eyes, the right wing. They're like, whatever. Or they're going to cheer you. So the cost-benefit analysis is completely asymmetrical.
Okay, now that's an interesting insight. I hadn't thought of it that way. I was thinking more along these lines. Thomas Sowell is a guy you and I both like, and one of the themes of his books is that it can take two paragraphs or three paragraphs to refute a one-phrase slogan that you see on a bumper sticker or you hear in politics. So for instance, the idea that, well, there must be racism or discrimination at work if this group is doing better than that group. And Sowell says, life is so unbelievably complicated. There are cultural and many other reasons that one group... How about the fact that Polish Americans are 25 years older on average than Puerto Ricans? Well, that alone is going to make them... Why would you think there would be absolutely equal outcomes between these groups?
Sure.
So what he would do is instead of just saying, well, I've looked at it for 5 seconds and I think I understand all of reality, he would take it apart gradually. Whereas I have found that, I mean, when I look at the modern day Democratic Party, I don't see any sense that, well, we'd like to provide these goods to the people, but there are, you know, unintended consequences. There's no sense of that. It's just, there's clearly one way that non-reprobates should think about this issue, and it's just give people X, and it can be fit on a bumper sticker. And so I feel like that's not the way a right winger looks at the world, that a lot of meaningful things can be summed up on bumper stickers.
Oh, are you crazy? Are you serious?
Yep. I'll defend that to the death.
Okay, you could defend it to well, the death's imminent. You spend 10 seconds on Twitter. You're telling me there aren't right wing bumper stickers from Hear the Moon? From My Cold Dead Hands? That's not a right wing bumper sticker?
Yeah, but I'm talking about why is it that the
Second Amendment defends the first?
Yeah,
there's a million of them. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I get it. I know it. But I'm talking about why is it that people who seem to live as if the world is bumper stickers, why is it that the overwhelming majority of people, and everybody that's listening to me has seen this, where you see that car full of bumper stickers, it's always coexist.
No, it's
always
not an overwhelming majority. It's the fact that those are the ones you're registering because those are the ones that make you roll your eyes. The other one, maybe they're not literal bumper stickers, but the right wing and NPCs on the right have plenty of bumper stickers in their psychology.
I know. There are times when I say to myself, you know, like sometimes like you're the people I'm trying to defend against unjust attack. I mean, it's very, very frustrating. I know. And just attack. That's true. But I don't defend people against just attacks. But I don't know. No, I still think that there is. I mean, for instance, the very argument about the minimum wage. Now, okay, the average, let's say, grassroots right-wing guy is not probably super reliable on the subject of the minimum wage. That's true. But in terms of the philosophy, I can understand why somebody says, yeah, well, of course we should have the minimum wage be $15. People need to earn more money. It takes much more thought to say, well, hold on a minute.
No, it doesn't. Of course it does.
The most obvious thing in the world is if somebody doesn't have something, well, we'll give it to them. What possible consequence could there be? We'll give it to them.
This goes back to the earlier classification of right wing versus left wing, which is sympathy for the weak versus empathy with the strong, right? There's going to be far fewer people at the very top. There's going to be a lot of people at the very bottom. So if you're going to sympathize with the weak, with the minimum wage, minimum is as low as it gets by definition, you're going to be a lot more popular. It's going to be much more of a common thing where you could say out loud, for one, especially in a culture that's dominated by the left. Like as we said earlier, it's the pussy hat versus the MAGA hat. There's an asymmetry in terms of the costs and benefits of speaking these views, because how many CEOs are going to be on the street defending you with that bumper sticker, as opposed to how many people who make minimum wage are going to be ready to key your car?
So are you saying there's an insincerity at the heart of it?
At the heart of what?
So when they say I favor the minimum wage, it's not because
no, they believe actually- it. They just they don't they'll the there's different types. There's the fortune cookie type, the bumper sticker types. Then there's the type to say, look, there's many places where they raise the minimum wage and it didn't hurt jobs. I understand your argument. You're full of crap. Then there are ones who say, well, the minimum wage is a lie because we're paying the welfare benefits of those people who are making the current minimum wage who can't afford a living wage. So we're subsidizing the wages of your employees, and that's not fair. So
right, but again, you're already arguing at much higher level than most people
would. All I'm saying is that there's two kinds of – I mean, the left is not – there's going to be the smart people on the left, and there's going to be the stupid ones, just like on the right.
But to me, that's true, and there are stupid people on the right. But I'm talking about on the highest – when I listen to the Democratic Party, when I listen to these people talk these days, it really is we need to help people, so therefore we should do X or Y. Now, the thing is, for example, if you raise the minimum wage $15, we all know there's a possibility that some people won't be worth $15 and all that. But what you also do is you increase the size of the labor pool because more people are going to be attracted to get into the market or are going to be attracted to those jobs who wouldn't have been attracted before. So you're now going to have the most vulnerable people competing with people who are more skilled than they are. So there's no way you can tell me that that's going to help these people. And they don't take the time. There's no sense to me that they've said, well, I considered that and I rejected it. It's more, you are a reprobate fat cat if you don't see that my one-sentence analysis of these people lack something, why we simply mandate it, is the correct way to go. I think that is the way they look at the world. And I think a lot of Make America Great Again people probably see the world roughly that way, and probably some of them think the minimum wage should be raised. But the point is, as a collective, like if we look at people on the left and people on the right, okay, I think there's much more often a jump to, well, there must be an immediate solution here, whereas the right, precisely because it views society and the economy as being more complicated than a moralizing schoolmarm, thinks there could be unintended consequences to it.
Or it could be that because so much of the right has leftist principles, they can't coherently articulate an alternative.
Well, we'll leave folks to adjudicate this one for themselves.
And I'm for raising minimum wage, as I was first on your show many years ago, as I dropped, because I want those cashiers to be out of business so I don't have to interact with them, so I can interact with a machine.
I know. I follow you on Facebook.
And it's happening, and I'm delighted. Every time I see one of those touchscreens, you know, I'll put up in the McDonald's or whatever, I want to cry.
Well, look, all right, that's Michael Malice, folks. There you go. There is Michael Malice. This conversation is one of these things that leaves you thinking, leaves you asking more questions. That's great. That's great. Come discuss them in our private groups. I have a private group for my supporting listeners, and Michael has a private group of his own, and you can get in there through his Patreon, patreon.com/Michael Malice. You should support him. He does great and interesting and important work every week, and he does it. He makes it look easy. It's effortless, it seems, but it's really hard to do what he does. So, Michael, I appreciate your time. I already told people at the beginning of the episode about You're Welcome and Nightshade, which they should be watching and listening to. And I guess I'll be seeing you in New York pretty soon.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks, off the beaten path here. Before we say goodbye on this episode, how about farmsteadingfamily.com? This is a website that a listener created. Subtitle, Stories and Information from Our Farmsteading Journey. And in his About Us page, he says, we started our farmsteading journey back in 2015 when we moved back to our home state of Michigan. We moved back to Michigan to be near family and to start a family. We moved states, changed jobs, had our daughter, bought our first home, all within the first few months. The home was in a small rural neighborhood. They built a small movable chicken coop from scratch. They got two chickens. The neighbors said, boy, we love watching them and hearing them cluck around the backyard. At least that's what they told them. They started a large garden at the grandparents' house. They planted some blueberry bushes. They tried their hand at tapping their backyard trees at maple syrup and learned as much as they could about homesteading. Then in late 2017, they found a fixer-upper on 3 acres in the country. And most of their spare time the first year was spent remodeling the house. But since then, they've moved on to fencing pastures, building garden beds, planting perennial fruit crops, and building chicken coops and tractors. And they're working toward the goal of small-scale farming for profit. But for now, they're taking baby steps and enjoying what this lifestyle has to offer their family. So if you check out farmsteadingfamily.com, you'll see a lot of posts about what they're doing, but also things like recipes and discussions of gardening and topics like that. So it's very much worth looking at. Farmsteadingfamily.com. And if you would like to get, well, of course, I'm going to post that at tomwoods.com/1372. You can get nice publicity like this for that website that is still a twinkle in your eye that you're thinking about creating. Just get your hosting through my link, and I will publicize it to my audience and give you some other great bonuses, including membership in our Mutual Help Bloggers group, so you won't feel totally alone as you're starting this new journey. How do you get all these nice bonuses? How do you do all this? Check out tomwoods.com/publicity. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Michael f***ing Malice, welcome. No, I'm sorry. I'm not starting that way.
But right. Start it that way and bleep it. It'll be really funny.
All right. Here we go. Yeah. Here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Michael. All right. Yeah, I'll actually say it and we'll let him bleep it. Yeah.
You have to say it, but then he has to bleep it.
Yeah. All right. All right. So here we go. All right. And man, was that guy a crack researcher. And I better say that again. Hold on.
No, I like leave it in. Yeah, he liked crack.
All right, Chris, wait,
you said crack researcher, not crack researcher.
Yeah, exactly. But there are some people who won't make the distinction.
Oh, come on, leave it. You have to leave it.
They'll say no. Look, this is a dog whistle by Woods, right? All right. Anyway, here we go. Maybe I'll use it as a for the blooper tape or something. All right, here we go. Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.